I got you some cartoons. They're not drawn by me, they're drawn by Ella. And I've got some maps drawn by Ben Hennig as well, that I have drawn the graphs you're going to see. What I'm going to give you is a series of pieces of evidence of things that have been happening, particularly in 2016, 2015, and then some guesses about what might happen. We don't have any particular reason to know what's going to happen. We shouldn't think that any of us are likely to be that good at predicting. We're in a lovely brief period now when few people actually do try to predict since the Trump election. That will go away. Within a couple of months, we'll be back to people telling you that the 2020 election is a foregone conclusion and it will definitely be held in 2020. I'm just holding on to the fact that you knew now that nobody knew what's going to happen next. But we know a lot about what has happened. I'll talk about that graph a bit later if you come to the end. We were much more equal. The UK in the 1970s, through even the first couple of years of the 1980s, was the second most equitable large European country by income inequalities. That's the country I grew up in. It was much better in terms of equality. We were poorer, we had less central heating, we had more outside toilets and so on, but the gaps in income were much less, the health gaps were much less. Until 3 years ago I lived in Sheffield. Sheffield actually had life expectancy above the national average in the 1970s. We've forgotten that we were more equal, and the United States was dramatically more equal in the 1960s and 1970s. And at that time, you could have argued that this equality was a problem, that it was wasteful, that you were not helping the most talented get to the top. And if you did that and made life harder for people who were more lazy, things would be better. You could have argued that because almost all affluent countries were relatively equal in the 1960s and 70s. But you can't argue that now. Because the United States and the United Kingdom in particular became dramatically more unequal. They became dramatically more inefficient. Productivity is much lower. They became relatively poorer compared to other European countries. The median wage of households is lower. Mental health is worse. Cost of housing is higher. Almost everything goes wrong. We've done this experiment and we've seen the outcome. You do get really low rates of unemployment because you can force people to take any job. Nobody should celebrate our low rates of unemployment in the US and the UK. Let's start with the USA. This is a map that Americans don't see. You're very lucky in the UK because you get to see maps like this, which are stretched so you can see where most people live, which means you can at least understand who's won an election. Americans still use traditional maps for election results. That's what the USA looks like in terms of population. You may only just see it. That was the 2012 election result. In the US, if you see the other way around, the Democrats are blue, and that's Obama's win. They're slightly more blue than red. It's a very strange map. The red areas, the colored areas, are stretched around the city. And you've just about got a blue majority, and that's Obama win. So here's the results of the 2016 election. That's the traditional map at the top. Most of it's red, because there are more Trump voters in rural areas in the States. The map at the bottom, stretched by population, most of it's blue. And it's not majority blue for Democrat, because Hillary actually won more votes. Although she did win more votes, it's blue because the areas in which Democrats are more popular are the areas of higher population. They've got more children in them. They've got more people who are not registered to vote. This was a massive win for Democrats. Unfortunately, the strange form of democracy that America has means that Donald won. So we're going to find out what Donald will do. And it's also worth saying that that map is quite similar to the one I just showed you. 90% of Republicans in 2012 voted for Republican in 2016. Wasn't that dramatic a change? The Economist magazine entered a little competition to try to find the best predictor of where Trump increased the popularity of the Republicans. And this is the result. Each of those circles is a county in the US. He has thousands of counties. The counties are drawn with the size of the circle proportion of the population. And along the bottom, you've got an index of poor health. And the lower it gets, the worse the health is, it goes away from me. And along the y-axis, you've got the swing to the Republicans. And you can see that in counties where health is getting worse in the United States, this isn't necessarily for the people voting for Trump, but around them, they could see that things were getting worse. Life expectancy has been falling in many areas of the US. That's the swing came to Trump that was crucial for him to win. And the United States, of all the rich countries in the world, is the only one that has had these sustained falls in life expectancies for many groups in recent years. It's not something we've been used to since the Second World War, but it's happened in the States. So if your world is falling apart, if it looks like it's getting worse, if you can't see a future for your children, and if increasing numbers of people of your age or older are dying around you, why not vote for the man who says he's going to change it all? It wasn't just racism. Because this doesn't correlate with racism, this correlates with health getting worse. We get something similar in the question of Jim. But not as nice and clear cut, so we can't draw a graph that's quite as convincing. We get a map. The normal map is in the middle and is small. It is useless. You want to look at these two maps. The one away from me is the city. Where's the majority remain, which is yellow. Where's the majority leave, which is blue. And the one nearer me is showing subtleties within that. It's a really interesting map. I've drawn tens of thousands of maps in my life because I'm a very weird person. I'm sure I've drawn more maps of the UK than anybody else. Mainly a social geography. Every census is 1971. And after a time drawing these maps, it begins to get very, very boring because they look the same. This map is different. It's not just a map of rich or poor or anything. It is amazing. Okay, Scotland voted differently, and we know why Scotland voted differently. They have a different enemy, it's London. But life's winners voted to remain. London is full of life's winners. If you're not winning, you have to leave London. London's full of optimists. The only people that also allowed to vote are people who were UK Commonwealth or Irish citizens. So the fact that London's full of EU citizens doesn't hold you this at all, except people are more friendly to people they actually know. The more immigrants around you, the more likely you are to like immigrants. The fewer immigrants there are, the more likely you are to think that immigrants are a terrible problem. Whereas the problem for your area is actually you don't have any immigrants. The worst situation you can be in is to live somewhere where nobody's turned up in the last 10 years. If you want an indicator about when a place is really bad, it's when people leave and people don't turn up. If you look at the more detailed map, you'll see that Cambridge and Oxford were very strong for Maine because they're full of winners, because as soon as something goes wrong in life, you've got to leave, because you cannot house yourself in those cities. In Wales, it's made big on this map at least, down in the valleys here, and Aberystwyth, and the hippies up in Gwynedd. But majority Wales is poor. Wales was actually bog standard average for UK. Wales did nothing of any interest in that referendum. It's been the average for the UK. It was the Midlands that voted more to go out. Wales was the most average of all the countries and regions. Majority of Leave voters, about 60% in England, lived in the southeast of England. I think 52% born in the UK. It's a southern Leave vote. When about 59%, 60% of Leave voters were social class A, B, or C. That message still hasn't got through. We knew that the day after the referendum, because Lord Ashcroft's exit poll, which was remarkably accurate, has told us that. It was remarkably accurate because people don't systematically lie to pollsters when they're polled in secret. It's just that many people only knew how they were going to vote just after they'd done it, when they walked out of the polling booth and were interviewed by the exit pollsters. Yet lots and lots of people didn't actually know how they're going to vote. It's a really interesting map because Liverpool voted to remain. Manchester, full of students, voted to remain, but Leeds didn't vote to remain. Sheffield didn't vote. Actually, Leeds did vote to remain. Sheffield didn't vote to remain. Liverpool didn't vote to remain. If you look at this map near me, the very dark areas are the areas that voted to leave the most. And they're on the East Coast. And the key thing is there are very few of them. They really don't matter. They could have voted to remain, and we would still have left. But we're obsessed with the extremes. We're obsessed with Middlesbrough and Sunderland. We're obsessed with Oxford and Cambridge. These extremes are not vital to the decision. The decision was made in bog standard average Wales, bog standard average England, bog standard average area had had enough and was willing to vote for the anything but this option. We can argue later about whether it's solitary, if it raises them, whatever it was, this deception about the NHS and 350 million a week. But what annoys me is that the simple map isn't known well enough of where. And in some ways it is quite similar to America. The dark areas have had high rates of very recent immigration. You can find a slight correlation with very recent immigration in an area, but not with what's happening. Let's go back to health. These four graphs are graphs of the four components of self-rated health that are used to help construct David Cameron's happiness index. Now, I'll put your hands up and ask you, how many of you can remember 2010 and David Cameron announcing he's going to have a happiness index, a measure of happiness? Not some. Okay, almost a majority maybe, half and half. How many of you can remember ever being told what that happiness index actually found out? Remarkable, isn't it? We just don't expect it. It began being measured in 2010, carried on being measured. It was a vague collection of indicators. So, of course, every year it came out, something's got better and some got worse. But I will happily argue with any of you that the most important indicator in the happiness index was the self-rated health question. And this is because it becomes much easier to understand this as you get older. What matters most in life is health. It really, really, really is. It's not just your own health, but the health of those around you. Honestly, that. Forget about getting a job, getting promoted, all the rest of it. Even falling in love. And I've measured this. I wrote a book called Better Politics this year on it. I measured 32 things that happen to people. There are only 32 things that actually happen to you in a year of any significance, which you may not believe. You have to get a book to see. And of those 32 things, it is dominated by health. So, we have this indicator in the happiness index. This indicator is showing every year falls in self-rated health, dramatic falls. I showed this graph first to my friend George Navy Smith, who works at Bristol. He looked at this and he just said, artifact, has to be false, must be an error. the sample's changed, the question has changed. You never get something like that. And so I believed him, so I didn't publish it. And then we got the year after, which I haven't shown here because they combined it all, and it was even worse. It was significantly worse. The population has not been aging yet. Aging's just about to happen. We have remarkably few babies in the 1920s and 30s. So the aging is only just beginning. The big birth cohort was 1946, and they are 70 years old. And they will become dramatically less healthy, and we're not well prepared for that. What made me believe the self-rated health question was true was that in 2012 and 2013 we got slight falls in life expectancy for elderly women, which we very, very rarely get. And then in 2015, ONS announced that 40,000 more people had died in that year than in the year before. This is the biggest rise in deaths. I've got the numbers down the side, if any of you've got good eyesight. The biggest rise in deaths, apart from 1951 or 1968, that were flu pandemic years, since the Second World War. The top of the list, 1918, that massive flu, was our biggest year of deaths. Then 1846, that was cholera. 1895, I think it was a very cold winter, maybe a bit of cholera. 1849 was certainly cholera. 1940 was bombing and soldiers coming back and dying. 1929 was cold, 1847 was cholera, 1863 maybe in cholera. They're all 1800. Regional Committee was actually a 9% rise in deaths, bigger than any since 1940. So why did nobody tell you we had the biggest rise in deaths measured that way since 1940? Because the data was released on the 23rd of June. Why didn't anybody, and it was always planned to be, it wasn't a conspiracy, it was always planned to be released on the 23rd of June. But why didn't anybody tell you a week later? Because what was happening a week later? Michael Gove was stabbing Boris in the back. Why didn't anybody tell you another week? You wouldn't believe how many news stories there were. That is a graph showing absolute rise in mortality, and it's concentrated amongst the elderly. And only a minority of it is a very small amount of flu. It's Alzheimer's, dementia, and basically not caring if people have failed. That's the relative increases in mortality by different age groups. This is a major public health event, the biggest public health event we've had since the Second World War. The only adult group to actually see their health improve were the 25 to 29 year olds, which coincidentally are the biggest immigrant group in Britain. And immigrants are healthy. They're not just productive, they're just stuck in hospitals. Yeah. They're also remarkably resilient, turning up in a country whose health service is falling apart. Which it really is now. If you look at the news today about how far children are having to be ambulanced if they need intensive care, it is absolutely shameful. I'll read out this quote, because it's not becoming radical to say these things anymore. Professor Sir Michael Arbutt, Professor of the British Medical Association, speaking this summer, said, it is government policy to increase inequality, to make things harder for families with children, and that will have an adverse impact on the health of the children, the health of those children when they become adults, the health of parents who are trying to make ends meet. We have got to a fairly extreme point of political disagreement about what matters in Britain and what it's okay to do. But politics, of course, is changing incredibly quickly at the moment. We've been becoming more like the USA for many decades. Gordon Brown used to go every summer on holiday to the US, partly to learn from them. Tony Blair was always over there. Both sides of politics. And the USA is the rich country in the world with the lowest life expectancy. It's a place to learn from. Just a few graphs for you, just not particularly strong correlation, but this is in for mortality rates versus inequality. The United States currently has rising rates of infant mortality. especially in Texas. And in Texas, they have cut the clinics for women who are pregnant by 75%. And they've had a huge increase in women dying while giving birth. That's the extreme end of things going on in the English world. This is my most nerdy slide, but it matters because until today, only one person in the country knew this, and now a couple of hundred of us know this, but nobody's going to do anything about it. Every week, ONS released the number of people who died about 2 weeks ago to help you spot if a pandemic's coming or something else. And this is showing you the numbers of people who died in the last 8 weeks. Tomorrow, another week's figures will be released. And in the last 8 weeks, in England and Wales, 5,000 more people died than the average for the last 5 years for these same 8 weeks. And those last 5 years were very bad 5 years. They included that 2015 mark. But nobody, not one of the four directors of health, chief medical officers, got one for Northern Ireland, one for Wales, one for Scotland, one for England. Not one of the chief medical officers will say a thing about this, and not one of them has said anything about 2015 yet. Because nobody actually has a remit to look at the data. Nobody has the job of actually blowing a whistle and saying things are going bad. It's been a little bit cold, but not unusually cold. We haven't yet had the flu come in. So what's caused 5,000 more people than average to die in the last 8 weeks? It's our completely fallen apart social service system. It's the fact we can't get people out of hospital into beds and the beds are blocked. It's the fact if you go on a Monday morning to an AAE unit, I was in one a few weeks ago, you just watch the elderly being brought in who managed to survive over the weekend and the trolley stacking up behind. And this is in Oxford, because we are not funding service. We now spend half as much per head on our health service than what the Swiss fund. The Swiss have the best health service in Europe. We spend significantly less than Germany and France. Only Italy and Greece in the last few years have spent less on health than we do. And that was only after their severe financial problems. We have a brilliantly efficient National Health Service, but you can't fund it so little. That bus that said 350 million a week, what it should have said, if I could have afforded to put a post on the bus, it should have said 1 billion and 50 million, 1050 a week. Because that's how much we'd have to spend if we wanted to have the level of health service that the Germans have. Because Germany spends $1 billion more a week on health than we do. Germany also pays far more into the EU than we do. So how does Germany find money? It taxes people who are well off. We stopped doing that in the 1980s. There are a huge number of papers coming out showing more and more connections between economic inequality and things you might never have thought to be associated with it. Along the bottom of this graph, I know it's not easy to see, is income inequality. It's the share taken by the top 1%. So the top 1% of the US taking about 20%, our top 1% taking about 14%. In all of Europe, there isn't any other country where the top 1% take more than in the UK. We are the most economically unequal country in Europe. You get the same on a Gini coefficient. The USA and Israel are more unequal than us in the rich world, and then it's us. Israel, the UK, and the USA are the equivalent of the Scandinavian countries at the other extreme. We are as weird as Norway, Sweden and Finland are, except we're the poster boy of inequality. We show what happens if you let those who most take even more. Our ability to share it out. And on the side of this graph, you've got the proportion of people who are cycling or walking to work. Okay, it's correlation. Why on earth should these things be correlated? I'm not saying one is the other, saying that they're related. So what is it about the United States that means that only 3% of people walk or cycle to work? And if you've ever lived in the United States and tried to walk or cycle to work, you'll know why. It's because you have a planning system that allows urban sprawl, you don't have public transport because that's a bad thing, encourages collective behaviour. My favourite, both against in Texas, is a mayor in a town in Texas arguing against pavements being put in because pavements were the road to socialism. You're walking together. You know, it's collective. Not on your own in your car. By yourself. The Netherlands, 50% walking and cycling. Now, isn't the inequality hot enough as this? It was a group of irate parents in the 1970s who were sick of the major child death in the world, who campaigned particularly effectively. But the Dutch planning system has been changed so that you can live and work near to where you are, and there are decent cycle lanes, and there are cycle lanes separation of traffic. It really isn't worth getting in a car if you can cycle. And half of their pensioners cycle. Proportion of pensioners in the UK are cycle? 1%. And it's not their hideous. Like most of our towns and cities are not hideous. It's not saying that one cause is another, but the same mentality that says it's fine to have urban sprawl, it's the same mentality that says people deserve to have all the money they can get, and we shouldn't stop people who are trying to amass money amassing it. The interesting thing for a geographer from this is that we've suddenly got a wonderful geographical experiment. Like I said, these countries were very similar in the 1960s and 70s, have very similar levels of equality. They diverged since then. Some become more equal and some less than equal. Here you've got the United States, the UK, Singapore, very unequal. It's a ratio of 10 to 1 of inequality. I haven't fixed these things, you get the same result no matter how you do it. And then you've got the bulk of more equal countries. It's normal to be more equal in the OECD, by the way. It's not normal to be unequal. And here you've got ability at maths at age 15. And it's a vague correlation. Okay, you don't do that well. United Kingdom, United States, we're down the bottom, but Greece is doing pretty badly. There's a vague correlation there. The PISA results, latest ones, 2015, came out last week. And I'm showing you 2012, not just because I'm not so sad that I instantly draw maps, but because in 2012, PISA did something else, which they haven't done in 2015. They didn't just test the ability of maths at age 15. Right? And this really matters for education, if that's for Wales. Do you notice Wales came out bottom? Okay. Don't worry about that. Here's why. This is the ability of maths at age up to age 24. Now look, I mean, to be honest, when you get a correlation that tight, it means there's a bit of chance involved, it's luck. But they really, really line up. Much more than they did at age 15. The most unequal countries, the UK and the USA, maths ability is abysmal at age 24. The most equal is much, much better. Now think about maths, and particularly if you're under 35, because you're taught maths differently, think about what it was like at school. Now a few of you might have enjoyed maths. Almost certainly everybody here had to get their maths GCSE. Most of you won't have gone on and done maths A level, in fact science, as you said, that's great, got rid of it. Quite a few of you, I won't embarrass you because I'm definitely going to end before the hour. Quite a few of you have got A stars, and quite a few of you have got A stars and A's at GCSE. Won't be very good at maths. You were just taught to get the A and the A star. Because that's what we do in these four countries in the UK. All teach kids to get a C, you must get a C. Because exam results really matter in unequal countries. Because exam results determine your future to a far greater degree. So you can't pussy about actually teaching creative, you've got to teach. And teachers teach set lessons to the curriculum every day because you've got to maximise exam results because it's crucial. The same in the USA. I spent a week once travelling on a bus in the USA because I didn't have a car, and the only other people travelling on the bus were children, people who are not white. Eventually one white man got on and he shook his cane out because he was blind. And that's the children, what were they doing on the bus? They were cramming for their snacks. I said, why are you cramming? They said, because if we don't pass, we have to work in McDonald's for the rest of our lives. Now, the reason I've left the graph up there is that's the kind of education system you get when you focus on exam results of 15, because they really matter. And this is why I wouldn't be too worried in Wales about not being at the height of the PISA score. The other reason, if any of you are nerdy about it, the UK had the highest number of kids who were supposed to be in the PISA sample not sampled in 2015. They're all in England. I think 700 children are supposed to be included in the sample in England, not tested, because they were said to be not quite so good at education. And the English have gone and put their PISA score up for 2015. They also included 19% of schools were private. Yeah? And there aren't that many private schools in Wales. So if you oversample the private schools of England, right? So I'm nervy, I look at these things. I'm stuck. There's a horrible graph. It looks fun, but it's no good at all. Very colourful. It's like the same one, black and white. This is IMF data. This is showing public spending as a proportion of GDP over time. So in effect, it's showing tax cuts. But it's showing what the tax is used to spend. And what it's showing you, just told you that there are these huge differences in inequality between these different countries in the rich world. There are also enormous differences in how much people are taxed and spent. You've had government after government tell you it's a global race, inequality is rising everywhere, we've all got to get our tax rates down, otherwise companies are working it. You can't have higher spending on failing public services because nobody has it. That's what politicians have been telling you for the last 20 or 30 years. And that's the IMF data. These are all the choices. If we actually had an electoral system which would let you, have a choice rather than have the voting first past the post. It's unequal countries that have undemocratic election systems, by the way. More equal countries, much more like that PR. In Finland, the amount of money spent on public services is projected to be 57% by 2020. And it went up during the crash because the GDP of Finland went down, so they taxed people more so they wouldn't have to cut services. Can you imagine them doing that here? Look at France. Okay, the Conservative candidate in France for the Republican Party is threatening to cut 500,000 civil service jobs, which I'm not in favour of. But all that would do is move France down to the level of Denmark in terms of public spending. France has really well-funded schools, like much of the rest of Europe, which is why it has hardly any private schools. We have private schools because we fund our state schools so badly. If we fund our state schools well, you'd have to be a bit slow to send your child to a private school. The rest of Europe doesn't have private schools. And that's where we're heading. We're still heading at the very end of the hand to 36%. Only the United States and Ireland will be more shrunk. And it's a choice. It's a choice. Except if it's never presented to you as a choice, then you don't know if you've actually made a choice to have some of the worst funded public services in the rich world. Okay, take back control. So who has control? It wasn't the EU, honestly. What the EU had control of, and the easiest way to demonstrate this, is this huge variation between EU countries. If the EU was in some kind of control, then you would have far more homogeneity. You wouldn't have this lovely natural experiment for a social scientist to see what happens when we do things. The control is disproportionately held by people with a lot of money. They don't work together as the barrel. In fact, they often oppose each other. Last general election, Ed Miliband was in the 1%, thanks to the income of his wife. Nick Clegg was in the 1%, thanks to the income of his wife. And David Cameron was in the 1%, again, thanks to the income of his wife. So some things have got better. Gender equality has risen. But all three party leaders are actually in households in well in the 1% by income. This is the most text. I put it all up because I wrote an editorial in the British Medical Journal this week. Doing something that's very rash. I'll be getting more rash of it. Suggesting that France doesn't have as good a reason to vote for Marine Le Pen as we have to vote for Brexit and as the Americans have to vote for Trump. Because for us and the Americans, things are going wrong in our societies. You're given a choice, and it's the same choice in both countries, you're given a choice between carry on as you are or something very different. Something very different sounded better to enough people. Now in France, I won't go through it all, but you know, more than twice as many hospital beds per person, in which people stay for less time. That's what you want. You don't want people staying for longer in hospital beds, less time. and people live longer. It's a dramatically different country. One problem with equality is that people tend to be more downbeat in more equal countries. They much more truthfully answer questions about are you better looking than average? Are you a better driver than average? You know these kind of questions? So if it's asked, actually Wales is interesting because Wales is more near the truth than anywhere else in the UK on these. But if you ask these questions to people, how do you compare to average? And then look at how much higher than 50% you get. America is where you get the most people saying that they're much better than average. Than it does. In places like France and Japan, you get very much nearer to people actually realising that they are average. My worry for France is that the French will not realise how much better their state is than the UK and the USA. The median household is on something like 4,000 to 5,000 more euros a year. That's the middle household, that's their income, and the parents study in Europe. And the cost of housing is less. And they get a bigger house. And it's sunnier. They've got no excuse. I don't know whether people in the UK say that's going to help me. Number of other cartoons. Every country has inequalities. But even in the Scandinavian countries, the inequalities are very big. The best of them are getting 4 or 5 times more than the worst of them. That's a big difference, but it's the smallest difference in the world. So what you end up with is a slope that looks like that, in which you can help people, they're not completely separated, in which you don't agonise about your children's school, because you know if your children end up in the bottom half of the slope, it's not the end of the world. But that's the difference. The cartoon that Ellen is drawing right now, which I can't show you, but you can imagine it, is what this country looks like. And it's like this. And the interesting thing about it being like this is that even at the top end of this slope, it gets steeper and steeper and steeper. Nobody's particularly happy. They're actually scared at the top because they can't imagine being an average. But at the very top, so if I was in the best of 0.5%, dropping a bit would mean having to get a mortgage, because mortgages are just for little people. Where I am, of course, and I'm well into the top 10%, I've got a mortgage. So somebody at my age, in the next 10%, can look up at me and go, that's not fair, because you're able to get a mortgage and I can't get one, I'm going to have to bank for my whole life. That's the kind of country we're now living in. And it's the country in which you have fear and worry right at the top end. And of course, at the bottom end, you have more people on the streets, you have much more desperate situations than you get in these bleak countries. I've got less than 10 minutes. I'll speed up. Take back control was coined by Matthew Elliott was the paid chief executive of Vote Leave. Not enough has been done to study Matthew Elliott. Before he became the chief executive of Vote Leave, he worked for the Taxpayers Alliance, which is an alliance of a small number of people. I suspect many of you don't pay tax, but it won't pay you now. He was against paying tax. He came up with the slogan Take Back Control. Very effective slogan. I think it has echoes of Tomorrow Belongs to Me. I don't know if any of you are old enough to know where that comes from, but I won't say that anymore. We should make our own decisions. Here's a voting map of the UK at the last general election 2015. And it looks similar to those American maps. Because we now have the greatest segregation between Conservative and Labour voters that we've ever. 2015 was the most segregated election. The highest concentration of Conservative voters in some areas and the lowest in others. Louise Casey did her report last week about cohesion and segregation and somehow failed to put this in. It's been in the public domain for some years. The purple areas, over 50-55% of people vote Conservative. The dark red areas, less than 10%. Really divided country. 1918 was the last time we were anywhere near this divided, and we're more divided now than then. So, I'm in Swansea now, and I'm trying to predict some interesting questions you ask, but I can make a whole series of predictions about you as an audience, not just because we're in a university, but because of the geography. And my predictions should be more accurate than if I'd made them 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. Because over time, places have become more similar in terms of the people in them. If I was not talking here, but I went out from my house in Oxford, I live in Oxford East, which is the only Labour constituency between London and Bristol. If I would go out from my house 10 miles in any direction, the majority of the audience would have voted Conservative. And I wouldn't have got this far through the talk. Different talk. Here's a graphic about the Osborne's last budget, Paul George, and his decisions. This wasn't the, like, the EU deciding that he had to give most of the best off and take most of those before. It's self-inflicted, and it's been self-inflicted for decades. New Labour did some of the self-inflicting. Just to preempt one possible question, New Labour in effect became Thatcherite, partly in terms of what they actually did. Partly because in Thatcher's first few years, she was dealing with tax rates which are much higher than New Labour ever did, and didn't do things which they did do, including introducing sanctions which reduced some of New Labour. Sanctions reached their height in the Conservatives and the Liberals in 2013, but a million people were sanctioned. And the amount of money taken from those people was more than all the fines taken from all the criminals in the country that year. That's England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and the Sheriff's Court in Scotland combined. It's an incredible sum of money for people who are poor. The question I'm trying to preempt is all the worries about the Labour Party. I do think people should not be surprised that if a party is reverting to becoming a normal left-wing European party and hasn't been one, it should find it rather difficult to change. And that's what's happening to Labour. It's trying to change and finding it difficult to change. Because Labour didn't do much to reverse this. Inequalities rose slightly between 1997 and 2010. Small.
question.
What should you do if you want to take back control? If you want to take back control, you should tax people at the normal rate at which they're taxed in the European country, which is roughly a 50% rate of about £50,000. That's how all those other countries manage to fund their schools and hospitals and transport systems. And some people don't like it, which is why they migrate to London to make their fortune. Those of whom don't. But while they're trying to make their fortune, they're actually working very cheaply for us. The other reason you should tax at normal European levels is it stops people being too greedy. Because when you earn far too much, 300, 400, 600,000 a year, the tax rate goes up so high that you have to be silly to carry on doing that. Which means that rather than hiring one banker at a million, we have over 2,000 bankers paying over a million. Germany has less than 200. And Germany has the highest number after us. Rather than hiring one banker at a million, you hire five little bankers at 200,000 if you have high marginal tax rates. And five bankers should be better than one banker. Unless, maybe no banking, unless you're wedded to the idea that there are only a few superhuman people. If you want to see the thesis about a few superhuman people, then look at the second paid leader of the Leave campaign, who's Dominic Cummings. Dominic Cummings was Michael Gove's paid spad for this. And he wrote a thesis that's still available on the web about ability. And so if you want to know where the thoughts come from, it's there. I've got 3 minutes of link for it. You spend on education account normally, you're not doing it. You have housing laws that affect the tenants, which the rest of Europe has, that's how you are a private rented sector. You can get utopian and work towards a basic income, but we're not Canada, which is actually the latest country to say it's an experiment with this, based on law. We didn't have sanctions before Labour introduced it. They're cruel and nasty. If you've seen I Daniel Blake, you'll know why. And most of Europe doesn't have £9,000 a year fees, and of course Wales doesn't yet. You don't need to do that. At some point you have to get PR, otherwise you get stuck with bad decisions. And you do have to worry about 1%. And essentially, if you're 1% this rich, you're going to have problems. All the countries in the world where the 1% takes so much have big, big problems. I promised to tell you what this graph was. It's a graph of GDP per head. You may be able to spot the rising 70s, 80s and 90s recessions, some of you lived through them. This one is massive. You can't really see the other ones, this is huge. We are not going to have much money in the next few years. John McDonald cannot conjure it out of the air. I think what we're in is a serious crisis. Now hardly anybody will remember this because it was my mother's formative years in politics. But the Suez Crisis was when Britain discovered that it wasn't the country it had been, and it could no longer go around the world telling people what to do. And it was a terrible, terrible shock. But it wasn't the end of the world. Things got better after the Suez Crisis. This is Harold Wilson's 1964 postcard. It might not look that jolly to you, but it's about the jolliest of Lowry's pictures. It's possible to imagine things getting better. You can get better without spending more money. There comes a point, and maybe it takes a long time to come, maybe you have to get to the point where I can talk to students in my university, this is Oxford, who have begun to work out that a quarter to a half of them might find things very difficult in 10 years' time, with a degree from Oxford, because they can work out the odds. 4% of children in the UK go to Oxford and Cambridge. The proportion of children from Oxford and Cambridge who get into the 1% is not 100%. It's not even 50%. It's not even 20%. And if you're not in the 1%, life is getting harder. Actually, just getting a mortgage in the South East is getting harder. And I think we get to that point when the middle class, and particularly the upper middle class is being harmed, is when you get change. That's when we got the NHS, and the middle class could not afford a doctor in the 1930s. National health service became much more plausible. That's how we got rid of grammar schools, when the middle class couldn't afford the private option and their children failed the 11 plus. We're again hitting a point with the middle class in trouble. Help to buy, the housing scheme ends on the 31st of this month. Government tax breaks, half of the private landlords ends on the 1st of January. Whole load of things about to happen. Gordon Brown used to always ask, I always thought Gordon Brown was an ISIS leader in the last 30 years, by the way. I'm just trying to show you a bit about the general point. I've always argued that we should have 2-3% GDP growth, higher than the world average. We're already one of the richest countries in the world. Why would you have a target at above average growth if you're worried about inequality? I don't think we're going to get it again. I do think we can live better within our means. Social mobility is worth nothing if you've got high inequality. For every child that goes up in social mobility, one has to come down. We currently have taken the word child poverty off the Child Poverty and Social Mobility Commission. It's only called the Social Mobility Commission. But an incredibly mobile society with high mobility is a society that are full of very petrified people, and people who've got no idea what society they're living in. So why us? This is my last slide. Why us and why the US? And why have the rest of Europe? It's not because we are genetically inferior. It isn't because there's something about us that meant that when things began to get worse and worse, we couldn't see it, and we voted in people who actually would give more money to a few at the top because we're so stupid. Right? No evidence for that. There's no evidence that the Americans are genetically stupid, and that's why they've gone for Trump and voted in president after president, who's actually looked after the rich, the Americans who are poor. America had an effective empire after 1945. It was the world empire. And a huge amount of money coming in. Its GDP was enormous. And when that began to split in the US, the rich held on to their share and they sacrificed the poor. Other countries didn't have that problem, apart from us. Because we had an empire. We just lost ours a little bit earlier. But we always told ourselves that the empire cost us money. It was the white man's burden. We told ourselves that we invented all these things first. We invented steam engines. We invented looms. I was taught this in history, you were taught this in history. Right? If you actually look at it, you'll find that invented all around the world at roughly the same time. Right? As all inventions tend to be. By several different people at the same time. But we needed a story about why we've become so rich. And we told ourselves a story that we were special, especially able. And that's how we ended up with an empire that we were looking after. And then when the empire went, when India went, when the African colonies went, which coincided with us becoming relatively poorer, we decided to say that we had some kind of internal problem. The English sickness, its trade unions going on strike, that must be stopped. Because we never understood that that empire was what made us so incredibly wealthy in the past. And I think the Brexit vote is the last gasp of trying to work out that we're not great because we have an empire. That making a trade deal with Australia to get coal really isn't going to work. And I think we're just going to have to partly go through this to learn this final lesson. That we're not especially able people who are being held up by others. We just have a particular history, which is it's understandable that we didn't understand, and one day we're going to become a normal European country. The only question is how long is that going to take us, and how poor are we going to get on the way of becoming normal. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Danny. We're going to take a number of questions. What I'm going to do is try and take two questions at a time, and Danny will try and weave a response to both, which is a nice challenge for him. Are there any questions? Okay, so one there and one there.
Thank you for your slide, particularly about how we take back control, but I think that those are all things that perhaps people in this room feel able to do. Is there any advice for what can be done on a local policy level to help move towards an improvement?
Okay, the second question.
You mentioned at the beginning of your talk that Liverpool was one city which you voted to remain, and the story behind that is that because there's a long-standing boycott in Liverpool of the Sun after Hillsborough. My broader question is, to what extent do you think that the media, both print and TV, legitimises this discourse of inequality, programmes like Benefit Street, for example, whereas 50 years ago you would have something like Cathy Come Home on primetime TV. You now have Benefit Street and Life on Benefits and such and such.
I think yours first. I think you could do a lot politically locally. So, and I haven't checked out the constituencies here, so I'm not going to put my foot in it because I don't know. I live in Oxfordshire. We have 6 parliamentary constituencies, 5 are Conservative, 1 is Labour. Things have become so serious that clearly Oxford West should go to the Liberals when they're second. 1 should go possibly to the Greens, although Bristol West would just do that. All the Greens from Oxfordshire could go over to Bristol West and campaign. So you can tell I'm not a member of any political party because I would be expelled for saying this. That's what we've got. But you have to have serious, serious tactical voting and not put up a nice, very electable Labour candidate in Oxford West where they will still come third. That really matters whenever the election is. The Conservatives only got 25% of the electorate at the last election. Conservatives and UKIP can easily lose if you do not split Liberals, Labour, Green, Plaid Cymru and SNP. And if we carry on doing that, we almost deserve our fate. Then what can you do in your local government? We have some of the least powerful local government in Europe, of course, because of that would be impossible, but people can at least speak out and say what they can do and what they can't do and explain why. In the case of my city, half the home inspectors are gone last year, which is why we're now seeing people on the streets with their entire possessions for the first time in Oxford. And I wish local councillors would talk more about it, because it feels so bad. They can't. The other thing that's beginning to happen is that they're having to abandon community centres to local groups of volunteers. And all these things might be interesting. The problem is when the boiler goes and the roof goes. There are going to be interesting things that come out of extreme austerity, which could end up with more devolution. The media in Liverpool, as long as it's circular, the more unequal you become, the more a few people take control of your media. Murdoch's trying to buy the satellites again now. So you have this problem until you get a crisis. It is solvable. It's not just Liverpool that doesn't buy the Sun. I think this is like only 8,000 copies of The Guardian are sold in Scotland. Now, The Guardian is hardly a right-wing paper. But Scotland has left the entire Westminster press behind. And it's possible to do that. I don't know who here likes it. The Western Daily Mail, is that what it's called? Western Mail. But I would look to how does Scotland abandon the London press? Because it has done. And of course, the other dramatic thing about the latest election is it's the first time since 1918 that a third party has got that many MPs. 56. The party who got more MPs than that in 1918 was Sinn Féin. If things get dramatically worse, we are looking at a second independent vote, but the SNP will pick a time where faced with the option of staying with this, and this looks awful, anything else is better. That's the trick of votes at the moment.
There's one question there, is there a second question? And no one there? Okay.
You've spoken a lot about the politics behind the political choices, and you've talked about Europe being a laboratory for seeing how different countries can apply different political decisions and have different outcomes. And similar things have been said about devolved UK, with different patterns of devolved powers being donated and its dynamic existence as well. Could you? Are there any examples of best practice when it comes to policies that reduce inequalities anywhere in the UK? If so, where and why? And if not, what powers might different regions be lacking, or which levers might they be lacking in order to enact those, even if the whole of the UK may not be able to drive itself out of the holes?
Mary.
I wanted to ask you to finish the comment you made about something different that PISA had measured in 2012, the different question that they'd asked between 2012 and 2015. And the reason I'm interested in that is I've worked on a couple of quite large STEM outreach projects, so the kinds of things where the universities have been increasingly asked to back up STEM teaching in schools. Since those PISA results came out, we've had education department senior people on the phone to us every day. They're very, very worried. But my projects have this emerging concern that perhaps the university should think twice about supporting these continuous moves to grab and increase higher attainments. I just think it's interesting because we're removed from the pre-16 education system, and maybe we can actually contribute some, the universities that work in outreach can contribute some more interesting commentary, but perhaps that's not a great direction to go in.
Inevitably, it's Scotland who's done the most. Perhaps the most successful little one is a few years ago they banned letting agencies from charging fees. The government down here said that it would fail, and the Chancellor in the autumn statement has now adopted the Scottish policy. It clearly makes sense to have more of this, but Scotland has greater devolution and greater ability to do it. Some of the decisions made in Wales on the NHS I think have been quite good in terms of outcome, and that isn't often said. But I do wish somebody would look at the PISA results for Wales and England to check. What is on about is a sample something like 5,000 or 6,000 children in the whole of England, 25 per school, just 25 per school. That's for the whole of the UK, much more sample for Wales and Scotland and Northern Ireland. But all the children who are supposed to be included in England who are missing, they're not missing from the other countries. 1 in 10 were absent on the day. And it just looks, it's the highest rate in any country that PISA included in 2015. And the inclusion of 19% of children from private schools seems odd. So I think it just needs looking at. I don't mind a well-done PISA survey, but the problem with the way that PISA is currently organised by the OECD, it has a particular agenda behind it. It's led by a physicist who has his own theories about education. He did physics at university. And they're very odd. I've written about them in a book called Injustice. So, for instance, PISA a few years ago published all these bell curves for countries showing how ability was shaped like a bell curve. And then after they did that, 3 years later, they released the technical report, which explained that they'd standardised all the data to make it fit a bell curve. without, because believe that ability is disputed as a bell curve. But the reason I like the idea of doing this kind of testing is it's what Finland does. And ironically, I'm stuck here because PISA showed that Finland has the best schools in the world. And what Finland does is have them off there, let teachers do what they like, pay them better. Ironically, the Department of Education, who sometimes are idiots, the Department of Education, when the case of Finland was put up, said actually teachers are paid higher than teachers in Finland. Now, if you compare euro to euro, they are paid higher because lots of our teachers live in London. Yeah, you get it? Now, why on earth doesn't the spokesman for the so-called Department of Education understand that if you're really going to compare teachers' salaries, you need to look at the cost of living and the income inequality? Because Finland has really low income inequality, a teacher paid a little bit more than average is doing really well. Teachers in this country are paid more than average. Right? You try and hold on to them in Oxford. From our average state school, we lose 25% of teachers every year, which causes huge problems. Sorry for a rambling answer, but the Department for Education has become corrupted since Gove and Dominic Cummings and a particular tranche of people got in there. And they're on a particular mission. The mission is being extended now with the proposal for having so many state-funded places in private schools. And it's to get to a market system in state education, where every child has a voucher, the child can move around between schools, you have a market of schools, schools can fail, others will succeed. Even the OECD says this is madness. But we're at a point of extreme madness, because we're at the point of the highest inequality. We've also got to remember, this current government has only been in power for a year and a half, and it's made up of people who, as teenagers, like Margaret Thatcher, and then had to wait all their adult lives with their particular belief about how the world worked to get power in May 2015. Within just over a year, the Prime Minister and the has resigned, and the Chancellor's been sacked. And now you've had to go to the B team, who are currently in, and you may have to go to the C team soon. But the group of people who are running our government now, without the Liberals there to hold them back a bit, were teenagers at the same time I was a teenager, in the 80s. And if any of you are my age, kind of teenagers who supported the Conservative Party, who were 3 million unemployed, was a very, very strange bunch of
children. Okay, a couple more questions. Okay, one there, and one there. Okay, so your question, please.
Okay, and a couple of observations that reinforce your points. One is that the other major European country that had a similar experience to the one that you described in the UK, which has also lost an empire, is Russia. Russia's experienced an enormous increase in inequality. It's also experienced an enormous increase in deteriorations in life expectancy and health conditions. Further reinforcement of your general argument, it's interesting that the latest issue of The Economist points out that the PISA results, when adjusted for income and wealth, show that private schools in the UK are not higher achievers than state schools in the UK. And if you're comparing kids with similar parents with similar levels of income and wealth, the state schools just do just as well as the private schools. Against some of your claims, you said that economic growth should be downplayed. What matters is upward mobility and reductions in inequality. But the work of Thomas Piketty on the capital of the 20th century, which is broadly consistent with your findings, actually argues that slow economic growth reduces upward mobility and accelerates the rate at which inequality increases. So that actually, it's if we were to return to higher economic growth, you would get greater upward mobility and some reductions in inequality. But the final point is that France, although you're quite right, has much more generous social provisions than the UK. Nevertheless, the majority of French voters, of people of voting age, think the country is going to the dogs. But their perceptions are completely at variance with the reality.
Yes.
And so they may still vote for Marine Le Pen, unfortunately.
I was really shocked at the figures around the increase in the death rate. And I was aware that a couple of years back was an increase in older women's death rate, but I haven't picked up that actually that's accelerating. I mean, the figures are shocking, and I just wondered how you're going to get them out there, what are you going to do to actually get some, you know, airing for So that's really quite incredible.
Yeah. Okay. The yours first. Thank you for that. You're right. Piketty says, I think we shared it, economic growth is higher in the more equal countries. So the UK and the US have had sluggish economic growth for the last 30 years. Productivity goes really low. When you force people to do a job they don't do it well. And when you pay people lowly, they don't do a job well. And when you pay people very high, they don't do it twice as well as they're paid very much. My worry is this wishing, Labour promising very fast economic growth again, which I don't think, even if they were able to get power within the coalition, they could deliver. Because our primary industry is banking, it's not something you can easily sell to the rest of the world, and we weren't actually doing something of great value for the rest of the world from it. But also, we are somehow going to have to slow down consumption worldwide, and the richest countries need to do that first. What you can go for positively is to say it would be great to have GDP growth in things which are beneficial to people and the planet, which is green energy, which is things which are created, which is stuff that's moved around on the internet. It's basically stuff that doesn't weigh very much. And you can divide your GDP into green and not green GDP, and then say you get as much green GDP growth as you want. But the most negative GDP growth, the New Economics Foundation did this a few years ago. They gave every job a salary, depending on how harmful it was. And the most harmful job they found was being the chief executive of advertising. Because advertising is getting people to buy things they don't want to have. And the highest paid person in Britain is actually Martin Sorrell of WPP, who, you know, he gets his money because he manages to sell more advertising to the entire planet and can burn it up faster. So as long as you count Martin as negative and people who are doing things that aren't going to burn the planet up, I'd be happy with high growth and greater quality. Publicising the figures has turned out to be very, very difficult. So we got knocked back from the Lancet and the BMJ on two papers I was involved in. No, there were lots of groups of people beginning to publish the figures. The life expectancy figures haven't yet been published. It's just that we know that there hasn't been a massive influx of very healthy people to explain this. There may be soon from Spain. The SAF, part of the reason it is fatigue at this. People in the know, the Guardian journalists in the know, are just used to this as a story. They're used to story after story of NHS failing, of things getting worse. And don't realise that most people don't know it. But also, we have not yet had our first published life expectancy figure dropping. Others have had cuts. So there's a delay to when we will get that. But to give you one more, in Scotland, there are data series that goes back 160 years in Scotland. And that 2015 year was the first year in 160 years where both male and female life expectancy did not improve. First time in 160 years that has not occurred. So Scotland had bad cuts as well. But the other thing that worries me, I wasn't going to say, but I'll share it with you. I'm really worried that from the back of some people's mind, there's an idea. We've got cuts, it's all terrible. But if a frail 85-year-old dies rather than surviving another 2 years to 87, isn't that better than cutting funding of primary school places or something else? And I can't help thinking that the age profile and the gender until recently has been identical to the women and how she were killed. And you can only get away with that because of attitudes in society.
Okay,
can I just say,
okay, one last question.
Really quick. I appreciate everything you say about the NHS. My partner's actually a consultant in the NHS. And what really grinds me as a sociologist is you're talking about all the cuts and people going out and inequality. And the problems in the NHS is falling apart. A lot of people work in it, say, and a lot of people leave the NHS because of all the problems.
But what really eats me up is when he gets so angry as well that people are going without care, queuing in clinics for hours and hours because of the lack of staff. They can't generate the doctors and the young trainee doctors to go in. They're desperately short. Yet there's no money for people, and yet they're getting agency people in, agency consultants and doctors, right, who are paid so much over the top, who sit there, won't to half clinic as opposed to their agency, so really they've got no ownership of the job that they steer with. The money's in the NHS, it's the budgeting that's the problem. It's going in the wrong places. I know that's a very simplified way of looking at it, but being with somebody who actually works in it, you're saying the same thing.
Yeah, if we... In many cases, I don't want to lose things back. So what might happen with a lady that's costing the paying the contents of schools, the paying council house, and then brings things back? Whereas progressive parties in the past used to argue about vaguely the future and doing something better. But in the case of the NHS, the old system of no private providers within, if you work in solidarity, you overwork, but you overwork because you're doing it together, didn't work. Before leaving on a slightly positive note about this, the real irony for being women aged 85 who were dying was that this is majority middle class women, because the working class did not make it to 85. And it's us. It'll be us. You know, you can forget entirely about caring about large swathes of the population anymore. If you actually want to have a better old age and you're fairly posh, greater equality is well worth it for you, because it's you who are being affected. And it's your children and grandchildren who are renting all their life. We've reached the point when we're no longer talking about Margaret Thatcher's days, where 30% of society did do well after Margaret Thatcher, and the top 30% got richer. And then you could just convince another 15% that they might, and you'd win. Right? We literally are now down to 1-2% doing well, and everything else not. And you're all going to rely on these services as you get old. And I'm optimistic that we'll begin to figure this one out. And part of the figuring out will be people appearing to be very strange in Parliament, saying things and looking like they're extreme on the left. But then within a year they'll look normal and our politics will shift. And the best evidence of this is the Chancellor ditching a whole set of George Osborne's policies and introducing a whole set of policies that Labour has advocated. And it's when the Conservatives move to the left that you know you're winning, just as when Labour moved to the right, you knew you were losing it. So I am generally optimistic, but we're going to go. Thank you very much.